Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a bill that would bar transgender girls from competing in female K-12 sports advances at the state legislature. A new study shows that Utahns who seek payday loans pay 652% annual interest. And Salt Lake Tribune fool-in-residence Robert Kirby retires. On the phone for this discussion, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Lee Davidson. Good morning to you, Lee. Welcome.
Good morning, Roger.
Also, reporter Bethany Rogers is here. Hi, Bethany. Thanks for being here.
Sure. Thanks, Roger.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning, Robert. Welcome to you.
Good morning, Roger.
And a little bit later on the show, we'll hear from retiring Tribune humor columnist Robert Kirby. Listeners, you can join this discussion with your questions and comments by tweeting to @KCPW or calling us. The number is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, some news that drew national attention and consumed a lot of local focus as well. Bethany Rogers, you reported on a bill having to do with transgender kids and sports, House Bill 302. Just remind us what it would do.
So this is a bill that would basically exclude transgender girls from participating in female athletics in K through 12 sports. And so basically what it would do is it would require schools in the state to sort of sort all of their athletic activities into categories, designating them as being for males or females or co-ed. And then it would prohibit students of the male sex, which it would define as, you know, being assigned as male, the gender assigned at birth is the criteria it would use. And it would prohibit students who were male under the bill's definition from participating in the sports designated as being for females in school.
We talked a little bit about this on the show in previous weeks, but this is similar to other measures being considered around the country, Bethany?
Yeah, so the only state that's actually passed a version of this is Idaho so far. It was the subject of an immediate legal challenge, and it's on appeal right now after a judge temporarily blocked it because of potential constitutional issues and problems. However, a bunch of other states across the nation are considering it right now in legislative sessions. It's a bill that LGBTQ advocates here in Utah say is being promoted by groups that, you know, attack LGBTQ rights around the nation. The one that has been mentioned as being behind this bill is called the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a legal advocacy group that the Southern Poverty Law Center identifies as an anti-gay hate group.
Did that group... I mean, to your knowledge, Bethany, and you might not know this, but did they write the language of this bill? I mean, who actually penned the bill? And tell us also about the sponsor of this piece of legislation.
Yeah, so I don't have any knowledge that they of how closely, I'm not sure how closely the representative in this case worked with this or any other outside group, but it's definitely part or fits into a national push to pass these sorts of bills that's definitely being backed by groups like this. The lawmaker who is sponsoring the bill is named Representative Kara Berkland. She's a freshman lawmaker, a Republican from Morgan, and she's also a referee, a sports referee. So she has some interest, I guess, herself specifically in the issue of sports.
So the sponsor is Kara Berkland, a Republican from Morgan. Is this, I don't know how to ask this question, is it an issue in Utah schools? Meaning, are there some specific incidents that this is stemming from that she is trying to address?
The way she has spoken about this in public, she's mostly focused on looking down the road. You know, this has been identified by Utah's legislative analysts and lawyers as being potentially legally problematic, and that if Utah were to pass this, it would run the risk of drawing a lawsuit on constitutional grounds. And her response to that has basically been, well, this issue is going to result in litigation, whether we pass this bill or not. And if we don't pass it, if we leave things as they are, you're going to see litigation down the road coming from parents of cisgender girls who feel somehow deprived of an opportunity to compete, feel deprived of scholarships or titles. So she hasn't really focused on specific examples of things that have happened. Like I said, more so looking down the road and saying we need to get out ahead of this issue. But that's definitely a point that that LGBTQ advocates have raised, saying, you know, that it's not as if transgender girls are currently, you know, dominating sports at different levels, that, you know, this is not really a problem here, that it's just a proposal that people are using to sort of ignite culture wars. And Troy Williams of Equality Utah even called it tabloid legislation because he believes it's just designed to sort of stir up emotions without really kind of getting to any existing problem.
And Troy Williams is one of a number of people who are, you know, to whom this bill is not obviously to their liking. Troy is with Equality Utah. Eventually, you know, effectively, it prevents transgender kids from playing sports. And there's that opposition, you know, from activists. But then there's also the man, you know, whose signature is required for this bill to become a law, Governor Spencer Cox. Actually, you know what? Before we go there, Bethany, just to digress even further, how close is this bill to getting passed through the state legislature?
So the most recent thing to happen with it was it passed through the House, and it passed with 50 votes of support. There were a few Republican crossovers who voted with Democrats against the bill, but it still managed to secure a veto-proof majority getting through the House of Representatives, and now is over in the Senate side for consideration. Where it'll be really interesting to see how it fares, Senate President Adams has sort of indicated that you know, he wants to consider this bill and review it and digest it a little bit more before giving an opinion on it. But he said, you know, acknowledges that this is an issue that is, you know, very sensitive and complicated.
Obviously, so yesterday, as I brought up, Spencer Cox, the governor, indicated that he's not himself happy with the language of this bill as it is written. What did the governor say?
Yeah, so he actually got emotional as he was speaking to reporters about this bill during a press conference yesterday. And as you said, he acknowledged that this is a difficult issue. And he says that he understands, you know, the points that people are making, who support it and who don't support it. But he also said that he acknowledged the ways that transgender youth in this state are often faced stigma and can face bullying. You know, it's widely known that transgender youth are at higher risk of suicide. And so he kind of alluded to that, saying that, you know, these kids are, you know, they're just trying to stay alive. And he said that he wants to find some better, maybe, you know, he implied maybe kinder way to address this issue than what this bill would currently do in its form now.
He talked about, I think you said this, that he talked about both sides being right here, kind of walking a political tightrope. And then he also suggested, yeah, as you point out, a grand compromise being struck or pointed to, you know, previous big issues that have been grappled with by various interests in the past and resulted in these sort of, I don't know, foundational documents. Maybe I'll turn, Bethany, I'll have you hold on just a moment and throw this to Robert Gerke, our news columnist. Robert, is there, you know, is there a bargain to be struck here on transgender youth in schools and sports?
Well,
Conceivably, yes. I think the point that Spencer's making is we don't want a scenario where you have a boy who runs track who shows up at a meet and says, you know, he's not a boy, he's going to compete with the girls. The problem is A, that doesn't happen, it never happens. B, the current High School Athletics Association policy says that a athlete who wants to compete with women has to have undergone hormone therapy for at least a year. And the hormone therapy is supposed to, you know, essentially, I mean, it's not, it's part of the treatment that these trans people go through, but it balances it out. You know, you don't have the same physical advantages, I guess, after going through this hormone therapy. And so that's why they set that as a threshold. And so, as Bethany mentioned, there are zero examples of this happening at the high school level. There were two athletes who were from Southern Utah University who said that they lost to a trans athlete and wanted this done. But the sponsor took the language that it applies to colleges and universities out of the bill. So it only applies to high school kids now. And we don't even know in those two examples, Bethany can correct me if I'm wrong on this, that the trans athlete in question was from Utah. So, you know, if they're competing against an athlete from Arizona or California or Nevada, this bill doesn't apply to them, and it would never have applied to them, and it doesn't apply to them now that they've taken the colleges and universities out. So we don't see a problem here. We have a policy in place. You know, everybody during House debate pointed to Connecticut, where there was an example where two trans athletes won 15 state titles, and they said it just completely corrupted women's sports. But Connecticut didn't have that policy in place, and you know, so we haven't seen a problem here. And so you kind of have to start questioning what exactly it is that they're trying to accomplish. If there isn't a problem, if there's a policy in place that seems to be working, that has safeguards, and you know, Representative Casey Snyder made an argument during the debate that, you know, he used to be a mediocre athlete, cross-country, ran in college, so he's probably considerably better than mediocre. But you know, he says his daughter, who runs cross-country, would never be able to beat him. But that assumes that you're going to have men who just want to, you know, transition. Men are not going to go through hormone therapy and possibly surgery just to win a high school track medal. It's kind of, I mean, frankly, idiotic on its face. And so, you know, the whole thing is built. You know, they build up these, you know, hypotheticals, these scare tactics. There's not any substance to it when you peel it back in at all. And, you know, there's also an argument to be made that, say, hypothetically, a male wants to transition and has undergone 2 years or even 3 years of hormone therapy, still has to compete with the men. And you know, that's not equitable either to that athlete. So, you know, it's fraught with problems. There's no indication that the current policy is not working or is not serving to protect women's athletics, as Representative Berkman couches it. And so that leaves us with the only explanation for the reason that they're doing this is you know, this national anti-trans trend to try to target people they don't like or don't care about. And I think it's really kind of, I mean, frankly, it's despicable.
And Gerke, I mean, yeah, you point out that there is a policy in place about when kids are allowed to participate in school athletics. And you already mentioned that. Bethany, before we actually head to a break here in a moment, there is, your article points out, you know, this isn't the only piece of legislation that is being run having to do with transgender children. Can you describe, there's another bill that has to do with surgeries for minors who are considering transitioning. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it would be a bill that would basically make it unprofessional conduct for a doctor physician to perform a, quote, transgender procedure on a minor. But that would also include, you know, it wouldn't just be surgery, which, you know, many people are pointing out is virtually never performed on minors.
Right.
But it would include hormone therapy, such as puberty blockers for kids. And that bill is being heard this morning in committee, in a House committee.
Okay. Robert Gierke, I'll give you the final word here before we head to a break. Do you expect? I mean, I'm giving you a lot of power as the columnist. Do you expect that the sports bill HB 302 will pass? And then, what do you think will happen if it does get to the governor as written? He didn't express a certain degree of reticence about the bill, but he didn't explicitly say that he wouldn't sign it. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, before I address that, HB 92, the one that Bethany talked about, that prevents the hormone therapy.
Yeah.
For trans students, it kind of gives lie to the whole concept of, we want an equal playing ground, because that would prevent these sort of hormone therapies that are supposed to level the playing field for these athletes that that are transitioning. I think Governor Cox spoke he got very emotional yesterday, frankly, when he was speaking about his concerns about this bill. He said he doesn't support it as it's written, so barring changes, that would indicate to me that he intends to veto it. And I wrote in my column over the weekend that his history on LGBTQ issues is a good one, frankly. And I think that he would, this is a time for him to actually put some, put his money where his mouth is. And I think he would veto 302, and he said he would veto 92. And so, I think they probably will pass the legislature. The House, the 50-vote House threshold is a veto-proof majority, as they call it, which would mean that they have 50 votes that they would need to override the governor's veto if he does that. We'll see what happens in the Senate. But I think if it does get to his desk, a veto's likely.
All right, that is Robert Gierke, who is news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a quick break on the show. We have other stories to cover, and we'll be back on Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune in just a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined via the phone by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Lee Davidson and Bethany Rogers and news columnist Robert Gierke. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can call us to join this conversation. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We were talking about the state legislature. There have been some legislative attempts to curb the practices of the industry that I want to talk about now. And Lee Davidson, let's turn to a story that you reported later in the week this week. And there's more of your reporting to get to, but I want to start with payday lending. Your coverage looked at a report on that industry in the state of Utah. What did that report show, Lee?
Well, actually, before I jump into that, can I give you a footnote to our earlier discussion on the transgender sports issue?
Yes.
Just want to mention that on the federal level, Senator Mike Lee has introduced similar legislation in the Senate. And also, Senator Mitt Romney has spoken out on the issue during a confirmation hearing for the Education Secretary, Miguel Cardona. Romney was appearing in front of some pictures of his grandkids and said he didn't want an unlevel playing field for them, and also thinks that there needs to be steps to stop transgender sports affecting women's sports. So I just mentioned that.
Thank you.
Now moving on to payday lending. Sorry about that. There was a report out this week by the nonprofit Center for Responsible Lending that looked at the average rate for payday loans across the country. And Utah came in number two. By their study, they say the average rate is 652% annual interest for a payday loan here. The only state where it was higher was Texas. It might be worth noting that's higher than state regulators here have found. They do a little bit different study. The new study looked at how much the five largest payday lenders charge around the country for a $300 loan for 14 days. In Utah, regulators kind of take an average of every payday lender in the state, still very high, 554% interest.
Hey, Lee,
and worth noting, That same state study says the highest rate charged by any payday lender in Utah is about 1,700%, which comes out to $30 a week on a $100 loan.
Wow.
Hey, Lee, this is kind of a basic question, but some people might not know, you know, what we're talking about when we say the words payday lending. Can you just define that term, what it means?
It's a high-interest loan. Back in the day, it was kind of considered an advance on, it would come due on your next payday. Essentially, you're agreeing to pay very high interest on a short-term loan, usually for 2 weeks. In Utah, the longest amount of time that you can kind of re-up these loans is 10 weeks. And that's basically it. It's okay. Just a short-term, high-interest loan.
Why?
It's not...
Oh, go ahead.
I should say it's not... there's no collateral. A lot of times you have to give them a check that they can cash if you don't pay on time. And a lot of these people don't have any money in their bank anyway, so that guarantee check bounces and creates all kinds of long-term problems, or can cause long-term problems.
Why are the rates, why are they so high here in the state of Utah as compared to elsewhere in the United States?
Well, as this study showed, many states have caps on how much interest a lender can charge. And the maximum rates or the average rates charged are pretty close to that cap. In Utah, the sky's the limit. There is no cap here. And so that's why they're high.
Okay.
Should mention that Utah used to have those kind of caps, but they were removed back in the 1980s. The argument being that the market would set what's fair. But that's also seen as a reason for the rise of payday lenders here in Utah.
And so I guess a question that I have is, are there alternatives to this industry, Lee, for people who are seeking that quick access to, to making ends meet? Is there a different way for them to go, a different route?
You can always try other things. People think of credit card interest as high interest sometimes, but it's worlds cheaper than these. The traditional things like ask your parents, ask a friend. There are some credit unions, for example, that would give you loans a lot cheaper. Often these are folks who don't have credit, who are, you know, just desperate. These can be cheaper than, say, bouncing a check and paying the fee that you pay for bouncing a check. Some people are desperate to avoid having their utilities shut off and go this route, et cetera.
Lee, what about legislative action to try to put curbs on the industry, you know, or I guess re-put curbs on the industry in terms of caps on interest?
There have been attempts through the years to put caps. It's never gone anywhere. The payday loan industry is a fairly high donor to legislators here. They have some sway that way. The industry has been more regulated in recent years. They've been doing a few things through the years, requiring checks to make sure that people, in theory, can afford these. They've outlawed taking out numerous loans to pay off older loans. Critics say it happens anyway, but legislatures tried to crack down on that a bit. There's some things in the work that still in the legislature this year. There's a new type of payday lender, essentially, seeking permission to exist that may have a hearing come up next week. And I think regular payday lenders will be fighting it, actually. It's kind of a complicated issue, but anyway.
Permission to exist. Robert Gierke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, this report from the nonprofit Center for Responsible Lending says that Utah has 652% on average annual interest, as Lee pointed out. Yeah, I guess your thoughts on the industry, on the necessity or not of payday lending.
Well, I think, if you just listen to Lee describe the way these things work, you can see that it becomes problematic because these exorbitant interest rates being charged to people who don't have money in the first place create a snowball problem. It gets bigger and bigger. And Lee has done some excellent reporting in the past about the burden this puts on our court system when people default on these loans and end up in small claims courts or justice courts. And so, I think maybe one solution would be for poor people to get better lobbyists and make more campaign contributions, but that is impractical, I think. And
wow.
So, it's the payday lenders have the legislature wrapped around their finger in a lot of ways because of these campaign contributions and because the legislature is inherently, anti-regulatory. So, it's a real problem out there. One legislator told me one time it's very expensive to be poor, and there's really no end in sight to it. The efforts to try to regulate these groups in the past have failed, as Lee noted. They've had a track record of going after legislators who have fought the industry in the past in some pretty underhanded ways, and anyway, they were essential in the John Swallow scandal from years back. So it's a very influential industry in the state. It's an unseemly industry in the state. But you also hit on this with your question, I think, that there aren't other options for people who find themselves in a situation where they need a low-interest loan because banks won't give you $300 or $500, for a few weeks. They are more interested in, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 loans. And so there's not any other options for this group of people. And it's unfortunate, but the legislature is, as we've seen year in and year out, is not inclined to do anything to alleviate this burden on the people who they're supposed to be representing because it comes at the cost of one of their big donors.
It would be interesting to look at the relationship between payday lending and a topic like homelessness. Lee Davidson, I'm going to direct people to your reporting at sltrib.com. Is there anything else you want to add to the story, though, before we head to our next bit of stories to cover?
Nope. I think we covered it.
All right. Again, sltrib.com. And I'll remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK or tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And Lee, you again this week covered Utah's senators in Washington. Senator Mike Lee has some complaints about social media giants. A lot of people have complaints about social media giants, but they're not all the same complaints. Anyway, what is it that Senator Mike Lee is saying about these companies?
Well, he's had a battle going on for months against folks like Facebook and Twitter, saying that they target conservatives unfairly and that they pull down their comments or put up notices saying that, this is a questionable comment. And he has been chairman of a judiciary subcommittee that oversees monopolies and antitrust. And he has kind of threatened in recent months that he thinks these are monopolies that are unfairly attacking conservatives. And so he's kind of vowed to go after them and break up their monopolies. When Democrats won control of the Senate, he's no longer chairman of that committee. Now he's the ranking Republican in the minority. But he put out a statement this week saying, hey, the Senate's still split 50-50, and if anyone's going to do anything on monopolies, it's going to have to go through me. I'm still a powerful guy, and at the top of my target list are these big tech giants and social media giants. And I still think they're unfair, and I think we're going to go after them. We're going to keep our eye on them. He put out a statement saying, they aren't content simply to profit off of us. Now they also want to control what information we're allowed to access. He's still not happy that, folks like former President Donald Trump have had their Twitter account pulled and others. After the election, when he was questioning if things had been fair to Trump, some of his posts had notices put on them saying, you know, there's no sign that there's been shenanigans or unfair election processes going on, and he didn't like it.
Yeah, he referred to the totalitarianism of the corporate state, and talked about the idea that that in addition to profiting off us, you know, the tech companies also, and he says, quote, want to control what information we are allowed to access. Robert Gehrke, the idea here is that conservative speech is threatened, according to Senator Lee, by these tech giants. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, this one puts me in an interesting situation because I think there is some merit to the claim that these big tech companies are monopolies and that they're too powerful and control too much. You know, your Amazons, Googles, Facebooks, they are largely responsible for what we see and what we buy. And so, you know, I think it's worthwhile looking at, you know, reasonable measures to try to put some guardrails on that. I don't know that I necessarily agree with them that they're stifling conservative thought. I mean, if you think that taking down or a business deciding not to provide services to Parler, for example, and its right-wing sort of insurrection instigation is stifling thought, then I think you kind of twisted the whole idea of free enterprise and commerce. But if your concern is that they wield too much power and that could pose a threat if it's misused, then I think there's merit to that. So I'm interested to see where he goes. I think there's an opportunity here for him to work with, you know, majority Democrats and some members of his own party. But I think he, you know, may be couching it as, you know, they're stifling conservative speech shouldn't be the issue. It should be the potential or the likelihood that they could stifle any kind of speech that they disagree with. And that's maybe where you end up getting a little bit more traction in a 50-50 Senate.
Although, and maybe this is a question for Lee Davidson, I mean, theoretically, these private companies, they could censor whoever they wanted to without any significant repercussions because of the fact that they are private companies. I mean, they get to decide who's on their platform, right, Lee?
Well, Senator Lee has pointed that out. If you're a private company, you can do whatever you want. But his complaint is that they say that they're not biased and that they're fair, and he contends that that's false. There was an interesting hearing last year where Mike Lee asked the heads of Google, Facebook, and Twitter to name one instance where any of them had censored a liberal. And two of the three had a hard time coming up with any. And he said, see, you can't do it. The other one said, no, we've censored, you know, liberal politicians all the time, including Joe Biden, or we put flags on for violence or something. But they insisted that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, for example, said that they stand up for free expression and want to be a platform of free expression. And, you know, we're not trying to censor anyone. We're just trying to keep things relatively accurate and trying to avoid violence and trying to incite violence.
Hey, Lee, we are very close to having to go to a break, and then we won't have a lot of time when we come back. And so I want to get to the other Mike Lee story you covered, which is that there's a group that is going after Lee, hoping to, you know, unseat him, to run someone against him and defeat him. Tell us what's motivating them.
Well, it was the impeachment vote last week. Mike Lee voted against impeaching Donald Trump, and the left-leaning Alliance for Better Utah launched a campaign seeking to unseat him the next time he comes up for election in a couple of years, and they call it Humans Against Mike Lee, which is an interesting title. The leader of the group said, quote, he's an extremist who enjoys debating semantics and picking culture wars instead of getting things done to help Utahns.
Senator Lee, you know, being targeted for his vote on impeachment. On the other side, you had Senator Romney, who, as we all know, went the other direction. He further clarified why he voted the way he did in the recent impeachment trial this week. I'm going to direct people to your reporting on that at sltrib.com and just bring in Robert Gierke for a second here before we head to a break. And Robert, the idea of, you know, the election, Lee isn't up for election for another 2 years. Is there a candidate out there, you know, in the Republican Party who could run against Lee? And I guess how strong is Trumpism in general in the state of Utah?
No, there's not another candidate who could run against Mike Lee. You know, this whole thing is Mike Lee using this as a big fundraising platform. I mean, he says that they're coming after him, vowing to spend millions against him. He sent out mailers pretty much every day trying to raise money off of this perceived threat, or you know this threat that he's blowing out of proportion. But the fact of the matter is that Trump is still very popular in the Utah Republican Party. Our competitor had a poll out the other day about how popular he is among Republicans and how popular Mike Lee is among Republicans. And as we've seen for the last 40, 50 years now, that Republican primary is the election that matters in these statewide races. And so Mike Lee is not under any kind of threat at all. I think but it also benefits him to exaggerate this movement against him and use it as a fundraising tool, which is, I think, exactly what he's doing.
Okay. I'm sorry to cut the conversation on this topic short, but we need to head to another break. And then when we come back, we'll turn to our final segment and then a recorded segment with Salt Lake Tribune fool-in-residence Robert Kirby, who is retired, actually. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Lee Davidson, Bethany Rogers, and Robert Gierke. Every Friday, we are live with your local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We, unfortunately, at this moment, have to already turn to a recorded segment featuring Robert Kirby from the Salt Lake Tribune, who is retiring. And so we are going to cut our underplayed stories of the week short. I'm so sorry to all of the reporters, Lee Davidson, Bethany Rogers, and Robert Gierke. I'll just say thanks to the three of you for joining me today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
We will wrap up today with Salt Lake Tribune humor columnist, or fool in residence, as his bio says, Robert Kirby, who after 26 years writing for the Tribune is retiring. Take a listen. Robert Kirby, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
So I want to ask basically some questions about how you got into this gig, because as I understand, you sort of fell into it. Is that right? The humor writing?
Yeah, that's correct.
Tell us about that. How did that happen?
Okay, I have to go all the way back to my childhood. When I was a kid, I suffered from ADHD and a bunch of other behavioral issues for which they didn't have any diagnoses back then, keeping in mind that I'm nearly 68 years old now. And all they knew is that I was an unruly kid and I couldn't pay attention and would do mean things if provoked. And so for me, a form of entertainment, the way to keep myself occupied and out of trouble was to think up funny things to laugh about or to say. Factor into that I lived in 17 homes by the time I was 19. My dad was in the military. And so my friends were constantly turning over. You know, every year you'd move and make another best friend. And so humor became my coping mechanism because they wouldn't let me buy beer when I was a kid. And so it sort of developed from there. And I used it up until shortly before I became a police officer and discovered that there was medication for depression and ADHD and that sort of thing. And that calmed me down, but the humor stayed there.
Yeah. And then you went into policing, which is a family business. But then you jumped out of it and you became a humor columnist. How did that happen?
Police work gave me a deep, deep appreciation for human irony. And it was something that I just had to write about. But I couldn't do it as a police officer because the things that I saw and did were private. You know, you go into somebody's house and see a temple wedding picture on the wall, all splattered with blood because the guy punched his wife. You know, if that isn't irony, then I don't know what is. But I couldn't talk about those things or write about them. So when I left police work, I got a job with a small newspaper in Utah County, and I wrote a column under a pseudonym explaining to the public why cops did the things that they did. For example, if you're parked somewhere out in the weeds with your significant other and don't have all your clothes on, and the cops show up and shine a light in the car, well, that's your fault, because it's the police officer's job to make sure that everybody who's in the car wants to be there.
Yeah. And this column sort of launched your career, and then you jumped to doing it as a full-time job. You write in your column, your final column, about the fact that you were sort of coerced into doing that by a Tribune editor. Is that right?
Jay Shelady, I was freelancing at the time, and Jay, who was the managing editor of the Tribune at the time, tracked me down and said, okay, now you're working for me. And he's an ex-cop. I was an ex-cop, and that's just the kind of mindset. So what did I say? I said, oh, okay. And next thing I knew, I was writing in the Tribune. And while Jay kind of steered me in several directions that he wanted me to focus on, we talked about Mormons and how it was okay to write about the church as a news aspect, but let's get a Mormon in here writing about Mormonism and the Utah culture from a humorous angle. And not many people appreciated it at first, but pretty soon it became unstoppable.
Just in terms of columns, you know, as you look back on your career and doing this, are there columns that you think on more fondly than others, or that you think kind of defined the Robert Kirby genre?
You're going to have me thinking up really bad things here, but let's see. Oh, one of my favorite columns that I ever wrote, I wrote entirely by accident. People had been asking me for the first couple of years, how can you write this stuff about Mormons without getting in trouble with the church? And it never occurred to me that the stuff I was writing would get me in trouble, because it was intended to be lighthearted. Well, I finally got tired of being asked if I was afraid of church leaders, and I wrote a column. I said, I'm not afraid of church leaders because they're old. And all things being equal, I was pretty sure I could beat President Hinckley up. I didn't say that I wanted to. All I said was that if push came to shove, and it was just President Hinckley and me out behind the temple, no church security, I could beat him up. He was old and I'd been a cop. So I wrote the column, and I thought later that night, crap, I shouldn't have said that. But the next morning, there was just dead silence. And that went on for several days until I got a call from my stake president, who said, Robert, I want to talk to you. So I went down to his office, and I was sitting in there, this very formal interview. He said, Robert, you wrote a column several days ago about how you could beat up our prophet, President Hinckley. And I said, well, yeah, I know I can. And he didn't laugh, which made it even funnier for me. And so we talked about how this was sacred stuff and I needed to rein it in a little bit. I didn't, of course, but he suggested that I do that. But it occurred to me that maybe I had offended President Hinckley, because he seemed like a guy with a really great sense of humor about himself. And in fact, I've heard since then that he did have a great sense of humor. But I wrote him a letter of apology. And in it, I said, Dear President Hinckley, I'm sorry I said I could beat you up. In my defense, I didn't say that I wanted to. I was simply trying to make a joke. I hope you understand that it's the nature of my job at the Tribune to do this sort of thing. P.S., I think I can still beat up the Pope. And I sent that off. And I didn't really fully expect to hear back, but I got a letter to me from President Hinckley's executive secretary, which really boosted my estimation of President Hinckley, because if you're going to be the spiritual leader of millions of people, you really ought to be smart enough not to put your name on a letter to an idiot. You get somebody else to do that.
What did the letter say?
It said, Robert, I've discussed this matter with the president. He wishes me to assure you that he's not offended. And good luck. Have fun. That's so great. Right there in black and white was permission.
How about, you know, you wrote about the five kinds of Mormons. I know that it's sort of, yeah, it's almost like an underground trope. What are the five types of Mormons, Robert?
Okay. Yeah. They're very easy to figure out if you've been a Mormon your whole life, because you've had to sit through interminable number of church meetings with these different kinds, and you bump into them. The first kind of Mormon there is a liberal Mormon, a Mormon who thinks outside the box, but is still a believer and attends church, will vote liberal, Democrat, whatever, and has their own ideas about a lot of things. But they still consider themselves more practicing Mormons. The second category of Mormons is the genuine Mormons. And there's only like, hell, I think only 16 of them. There was one in England, but she died. Then comes conservative Mormons, and there are a lot of those. Mm-hmm. Orthodox Mormons and Nazi Mormons. Wow. And I explained how to recognize the various type of Mormon. And that thing took off like a rocket. I was getting fan mail from Vermont, from England, from Australia, because they all knew Mormons like this. And we're glad that they now had a sort of a color chart to go with saying who they were dealing with.
How about columns that you maybe look back on and, I don't know, regret or...
Oh, yeah, I got a couple of those.
Okay, tell me.
Years ago, the American Pilots Association was offering free pilot lessons, or come and fly an airplane with us, we'll show you how it's done, and as a way of encouraging people to get their pilot's license. So I went out to Salt Lake Airport, met the guys, got in an airplane with them, sat in the co-pilot seat, and we flew around Salt Lake Valley. And at one point I was actually had my hands and I was in control of the airplane. And it was really interesting, both in how easy it is to fly, but also how much you have to know in order to do it. And I went home, wrote that column up. I wrote about, you know, how idiots shouldn't get pilot licenses because they'll land on the freeway and under bridges and bash into buildings and everything. That column ran on 9/11.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But since the CIA didn't see that coming, I don't know how I could have.
Boy, strange coincidences of history. We live in a kind of sensitive world. Your column frequently had as its target yourself, but you know, as you pointed out, you targeted groups of people, fellow members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Is there less of a place in the world today for humor writing? I mean, do you feel like humor columnists, humor writers are less welcome than they once were, or were they always on the outskirts? I don't know.
It's largely by choice that humor writers are leaving the public forum, unless you're paying to see them, say, at a comedy club. But there are a lot of big-name comedians in America today who won't play, for example, college campuses, because nobody takes themselves more seriously than kids with new ideas. And it's unfortunate that's the way that it is, because humor is so indispensable to human beings. Humor is, you know, Mark Twain said it best, that humor is the best self-defense weapon that human beings have. In fact, it's the only one that really works, because let me tell you a secret, you're going to die. And you better have as much fun as you can between now and when that happens. And laughter, sharing laughter with other people, especially if you can get them to laugh about and with you about yourself, it's a great bonding tool. And frankly, I think if we had people with more sense of humor running governments, there'd be a lot less conflict.
Robert, we got to wrap up here in just a second, but you brought up Mark Twain, and I wanted to ask you who your major influences are when it comes to being a satirist. Was Twain one of them?
Oh, very definitely. By the time I was in the fifth grade, I'd read Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, most of those. My favorite book of his, Roughing It,
yeah,
where he writes about crossing the plains with his brother and heading out for the gold fields, and a stop he made in Salt Lake City, where he met Brigham Young. If you ever get a chance to read that chapter, do. It's hilarious.
I've been reading Life on the Mississippi lately. It's fun reading. Robert Kirby, what are you going to do now?
I got a book that I want to finish writing. I have some history research. I'm the historian for the Utah Law Enforcement Memorial. I read history in order to find officers who've been killed and then forgotten so we can get their names on the memorial at the Capitol. Corrupting my grandkids?
We would expect nothing less. Robert Kirby, congratulations on a storied career and best of luck in retirement. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Again, that's now retired Salt Lake Tribune humor columnist Robert Kirby wrapping up today's edition of Behind the Headlines.